Hi, Dave Emery here, side two of For the Record program number 798. Thrive on This, Counterculture Fascism in Cinema. This is being recorded on June 15th of the year 2014. We're going to plunge right back in with our reading of an article titled The Dangers Behind the Cult Film Thrive. It's by Eric Johnson. He wrote this, the article was carried in the San Jose Metro of May 16th of the year 2012. And I hope to interview Eric Johnson soon to go into some of this at greater length and greater detail, because counterculture fascism is definitely something of a flavor du jour in certain circles, and it's a point I would like to explore at greater length and hope to do so before too much longer with Mr. Johnson. Now, in the film Thrive, which mixes in some very worthwhile ideas and some very worthwhile people with some outright fascist ideas and exponents, the co-producer of the film, a guy named Foster Gamble, that's F-O-S-T-E-R, last name G-A-M-B-L-E. He is the heir to the Procter and Gamble fortune that makes Wash Day products, and that is the Foster Gamble being alluded to here. Another fellow who is alluded to here, and whom we will go into perhaps at greater length later, is a worthwhile person, also an heir to a fortune. However, he has basically kept his navigational instruments properly tuned. That's environmentalist John Robbins, R-O-B-B-I-N-S as in Sam. He is the heir to the Baskin and Robbins ice cream enterprise. One of the main influences on Foster Gamble and on Thrive is Eustace Mullins, basically a quasi-Nazi and one of the generators of the anti-Semitic fascist banking conspiracies woven around the Federal Reserve. Returning to Eric Johnson's article, he, environmentalist John Robbins, says that in private correspondence, he learned that his friend Foster Gamble was being influenced by the ideas of Eustace Mullins, first name E-U-S-T-A-C as in Charlie E, last name M-U-L-L-I-N-S, whom he calls, quote, the most anti-Semitic public figure in U.S. history. Unquote. I would add he's got a lot of company. I might suggest Henry Ford, the famous automobile manufacturer and American industrialist, and also a key financier of Adolf Hitler. However, he has a lot of company. Continuing, Foster Gamble did not respond to an email request for an interview, but there is certainly evidence in Thrive that Mullen's views influenced him. One of the central features of the film is the supposed revelation that the Federal Reserve Bank is a criminal enterprise. Mullins is the man who gave birth to that theory in his 1952 book, The Secret of the Federal Reserve. The following year, Mullins published his most notorious tract, Adolf Hitler, An Appreciation, unquote, which praises the Führer for his crusade against the, quote, Jewish international bankers, unquote, who were attempting to take over the world. In subsequent books, Mullins argued that the Holocaust never happened and that the Jewish race is inherently, quote, parasitic, unquote. Incredibly, Mullins also insisted until his death that he was not an anti-Semite. And then in the last section here, Eric Johnson notes that one of the principal messages, one of the principal ideological messages and components of Thrive is the right libertarian laissez-faire small government or no government economics that one can find from Grover Norquist, Karl Rove, the mainstream Republican Party, through the so-called libertarian wing of the Republican Party. It is all over the place. The Koch brothers, Ron and Rand Paul, the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and it is making its way into the so-called progressive sector as always. Note the use of the term so-called, courtesy of people like Edward Snowden, who is as far to the right as you can possibly get, Julian Assange, who is as far to the right as you can possibly get, their political idols, Ron Paul, the Ludwig von Mises Institute, which is explicitly anti-democratic, explicitly pro-slavery, and not surprisingly, inextricably linked with the white supremacist movement. And interestingly enough, one of the primary economic theoreticians whom Foster Gamble relies on is Ludwig von Mises, who, along with Friedrich von Hayek, arguably the best known members of the Austrian School of Economics. We have looked at the Austrian School not only in our length and in detail, and for the record, 756 and others of the Eddie the Friendly Spook series, but the Austrian School is also to be found throughout the overlapping Bitcoin milieu as well. And again, not surprisingly, the Ludwig von Mises and the explicit anti-democracy ideology and philosophy is front and center in the film Thrive. Continuing with Eric Johnson's article. Most of the solutions that Thrive puts forward will resonate positively with its target audience of spiritually inclined progressives. Stay informed, shop local, eat organic, avoid GMOs, etc. But not all. Given the troubling complexities of Part 2, I was only slightly surprised to find that one of the values of the future that Thrive depicts is, quote, little or no taxes, unquote. No taxes? Sounds good, but does that mean no public libraries? No state parks? No public transportation? How about roads? How about Social Security? Haven't the gambles seen what this kind of anti-tax rhetoric has gotten us? Doubled tuitions at the University of California, huge Reagan-era-style cuts in social services, decaying infrastructure. I would interject also inadequate supervision of food inspection and inadequate regulation of what goes into the food supply and the medicines and the water, some of the very things that the makers of the film are espousing are in fact profoundly undermined through this, because basically the libertarian "we don't want no government" leads to what Mussolini called the corporate state. Mussolini described fascism, and he invented the word and the system of government. Mussolini said, "Il fascismo e il corporatismo." Fascism is corporatism. Continuing, and actually reiterating the last sentence, no, the last couple of sentences, no taxes. Sounds good, but does that mean no public libraries, no state parks, no public transportation? How about roads, Social Security? Haven't the gambles seen what this kind of anti-tax rhetoric has gotten us? Doubled tuitions at the University of California, huge Reagan-era-style cuts in social services, decaying infrastructure. Near the film's conclusion, Gamble reveals the source of his anti-tax position, reverently introducing a man he credits with providing him with his core navigational insight for the future, Ludwig von Mises. He does not mention that von Mises is the touchstone of right libertarians, so-called anarcho-capitalists, and radical Republicans such as Michelle Bachmann, who quipped last year that she reads von Mises on the beach. Gamble does lay out the core of von Mises' philosophy of, quote, non-violation, in which, quote, nobody gets to violate you or, ahem, your property, unquote. That philosophy translates into three rules: no involuntary taxation, no involuntary governance, and no monopoly of force. In case anyone misses the point that the state must wither so that man can be free, Gamble shares von Mises' opinion that, like communism, fascism, and socialism, quote, democracy wrongly assumes the rights of the collective or the group over the rights of the individual, unquote. Continuing and skipping down, we're going to go into the explicit anti-democratic views of the Austrian School of Economics. Again, Ludwig von Mises is one of the best known of it, of the members of the Austrian School, along with Friedrich von Hayek, whom we're going to go into shortly, a man I believe was actually a Third Reich intelligence operative, von Mises may very well have been the same. Both were Austrian emigres to the U.S. and Britain, and the Austrian school really is a fascist economic theory, only it doesn't say, well, this is fascism. It says, well, we believe in freedom and that the state cannot regulate private property. There is an old aphorism that says the golden rule is he who has gold rules, basically. It's a form of economic might makes right. And people, as I've noted, have long sought the machinery of government and a rigorous governance in order to protect themselves from violation by powerful economic and political figures. Without a strong state, what you get is a corporate state, or what Mussolini said, il fascismo e il corporatismo. Fascism is corporatism. One of the things that Eric Johnson notes is that many of the people featured in Thrive later, when they saw how their work was being used, they were simply filmed and then their footage was incorporated into this. They denounced the film itself. Returning to Eric Johnson's article, last fall, the acclaimed environmentalist and nutrition guru John Robbins was invited to the home of his friends Foster and Kimberly Carter Gamble near Santa Cruz to view the Gambles' just-completed film, Thrive. Robbins, who makes a brief appearance in the film, said he was, quote, overwhelmed, unquote, by what he saw. There were parts I liked, but there were other parts that I just detested, he recalls. I didn't want to be rude. We were there with our families, so I just didn't say anything, unquote. Thrive, which was released online in November of 2011, had its theater debut in March of 2012, and is now touring the country, is an uncanny hodgepodge of pseudoscience, utopian fantasy, and veiled right-wing conspiracy theory. Strangely, it also includes on-screen interviews with a number of bona fide progressives, environmentalists, and spiritual leaders. In addition to Robbins, author of the groundbreaking Diet for a New America in 1987, the film features conversations with Deepak Chopra, the superstar self-help author, Paul Hawken, H-A-W-K-E-N, the green entrepreneur and environmental economist, Elizabeth Sahturis, S-A-H-T-O-U-R-S, the evolutionary biologist and philosopher, Dwayne Elgin, the futurist and author of Voluntary Simplicity, Vandana Shiva, the physicist and advocate for sustainable agriculture, and former astronaut Edgar Mitchell. In the months since the film's release, Robin says he has been in communication with all of these folks. He wasn't surprised to find that many of them agreed with his assessment of the film. While they might have hoped the film would just disappear, Thrive has become something of a web cult phenomenon. By some estimates, it's been seen by more than 1 million people. Now they have decided to speak out. Robbins, Chopra, Hawken, Sahturis, Elgin, Shiva, and Mitchell recently issued a statement saying that they have, quote, grave disagreement with some of the film's content, unquote. And again, one really has to be careful about being seduced in this regard. To understand, I think, in many ways, the core of what really lies at the foundation, not just of Thrive and other similar counterculture fascist works such as the aforementioned Zeitgeist film, which involves some of the same people and incorporates some of the same ideologies, looking at the effect of another key member of the Austrian School of Economics, a guy named Friedrich von Hayek, I think will perhaps be instructive. Von Hayek, in 1944, published a book called The Road to Serfdom, in which he equated Stalinist socialism, fascism, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal and democracy itself. And the book is explicitly anti-democratic and has garnered a lot of gravitas. Time permitting, we're going to go into what I believe is the real key to the publication of that book. The American edition came out in late 1944. The British edition in early 44. We're going to talk about the very real possibility. I think it's a certainty. Well, I am very much of the opinion that von Hayek was a Third Reich intelligence operative and propaganda asset. From the Naked Capitalism website of June 12th of 2014, there was a post by Eve Smith. It's actually an article by Bill Black and originally published in New Economics Perspectives. Bill Black, How Hayek Helped the Worst to Get to the Top in Economics and as CEOs. And by the way, Bill Black is the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. And this reads, this post reads in part, Libertarians are profoundly anti-democratic. The folks at the Cato Institute, by the way, with which Glenn Greenwald has networked considerably, the folks at the Cato Institute that I debate make no bones about their disdain for and fear of democracy. Friedrich von Hayek is so popular among libertarians because of his denial of the legitimacy of democratic government and his claims that it is inherently monstrous and it is murderous to its own citizens. Here's an example from a libertarian professor based in Maryland. When government uses its legal monopoly on coercion to confiscate one's personal property and give it to another, it is engaging in what would normally be called theft. Calling this immoral act democracy, unquote, majority rule, unquote, or progressive taxation, unquote, does not make it moral. Under democracy, rulers confiscate the income of productive members of society and redistribute it to various supporters in order to keep themselves in power. In order to finance a campaign, a politician must promise to steal, i.e. tax money from those who earned it, and give it to others who have no legal or moral right to it. There are very few exceptions, but politicians must also make promises that they know they can never keep, i.e. lie. This is why so few moral people are elected to political office. The most successful politicians are those who are the least hindered by strong moral principles. They have the least qualms about confiscating others' property in order to maintain their own power, perks, and income. In his best-selling 1944 book, The Road to Serfdom, Nobel laureate economist F. A. Hayek described this phenomenon in a chapter, Chapter 10, entitled Why the Worst Get on Top. But von Hayek's critique of democratic government, and this is the author then jumping in, but von Hayek's critique of democratic government has proven to be the most monstrous blood libel of the post-World War II era, falsely declaring that democratic government must end in tyranny and the mass murder of its own people. Again, this last sentence. But von Hayek's critique of democratic government has proven to be the most monstrous blood libel of the post-World War II era, falsely declaring that democratic government must end in tyranny and the mass murder of its own people. The political scientist Hermann Finer, F-I-N-E-R, denounced The Road to Serfdom as, quote, the most sinister offensive against democracy to emerge from a democratic country for many years, unquote. The economist Paul Samuelson, in a reminiscence of Hayek published last December, was more dismissive still. Quote, where are their horror camps, he asked, referring to right-wing bugaboos like Sweden with its generous welfare spending. Almost 70 years after Hayek sounded his alarm, quote, hindsight confirms how inaccurate its innuendo about the future turned out to be, unquote. Economists claim that their work should be evaluated based on predicted success. Von Hayek was made a Nobel laureate in 1974, 3 decades after his prediction that democratic states were headed to tyranny and mass murder of their own citizens. In those 3 decades of experience in the nations we focused on, Western Europe, the U.S., Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, and the 40 years since his award, this happened in 0 nations. He is batting 0 for 70 years in roughly 30 nations with collectively thousands of elections. What he claimed was inevitable has never occurred. Wesley Marshall and I are writing a book about why, disproportionately, economics bestows its top honors on those who fail their own purported test of success, predictive ability. This is the only field of academic study in which this occurs. We are trying to answer von Hayek's question, but it is in his own field why the worst, but it is his own field why the worst get on top. Why do the von Hayeks of the world, the very worst of economists, get on top? And skipping down in this. The worst abuses, mass murder, and torture have been committed by fascist regimes that von Hayek supported, such as Pinochet in Chile. When we ask why von Hayek receives a Nobel Prize and remains Glenn Beck's hero, we cannot explain the results based on facts and predictive success, i.e. failure. Instead, we must look outside the realm of reality and enter into the realms that von Hayek glorified, ideology, and greed. Von Hayek received his Nobel Prize because he was willing to be so wrong about so many things. His blood libel about the democratic governments of, quote, the West, unquote, was useful to another group in which the worst get on top in far too many cases, imperial CEOs. Skipping down again. Von Hayek, therefore, has to argue that a democratic system of government designed to prevent the creation of absolute power will invariably produce absolute power. Skipping down again. What we are reading, of course, is the class hatred and bigotry common to minor Austrian aristocrats like von Hayek, who were born in the 19th century. The fact that this kind of naked bigotry in this passage that I have quoted at length is viewed by his libertarian devotees as von Hayek's finest work reveals the depths of libertarian hate for and fear of democratic government. And again, noting that Friedrich von Hayek was an emigre. He was living in Britain for most of the Second World War. He was from Austria, and so was Ludwig von Mises. They left Austria. I am very, very suspicious of both of them. And again, more from Bill Black about von Hayek. Under his own logic, CEOs can use the seeming legitimacy, power, and wealth of, quote, their, unquote, corporations to serve directly as these demagogues or fund and control proxy demagogues that will serve their interests. They have vastly greater economic resources, and they have the expertise that comes from advertising to run propaganda campaigns. They also had tremendous expertise in the era von Hayek was describing in Divide and Conquer Strategies in the Colonies that would be easily translated into efforts to split workers along ethnic lines. Now, we're going to jump to a captured German document. This specifically was from the Abwehr, that was German military intelligence. This was authored by Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, and it was issued basically to German intelligence on March 15th of 1944. It's titled, this is from the book, in Appendix to Germany Plots with the Kremlin by T.H. Tettens, published in 1953 by Henry Schumann and Company. T.H. Tettens, an advisor to the U.S. both at the Nuremberg trials and to U.S. Army intelligence in World War II. Directive of the German High Command on Political Warfare in the USA. The following directive was issued by the Chief of the Intelligence Division of the German High Command, Admiral Walker Wilhelm Canaris, in 1944. The document lays bare the basic German strategy of scaring the USA with Bolshevism. Secret State Matter, Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, Abwehr, March 15, 1944. At a meeting of the representatives of the Foreign Office, the Security Division, Sicherheitsdienst, that's SS Intelligence, and the Department of Defense, Abwehr, the following resolutions were adopted for unified action by all of our agents in foreign countries. Utilize to the fullest extent all available possibilities in neutral and enemy countries in order to support our military efforts with political and propaganda campaigns. One, our goal is to crush the enemy's plan, whose object is to destroy forever the German Reich militarily, economically, and culturally. The new regulations put into effect by the political leaders for the dissolution and disintegration of the enemy bloc should be carried out more intensely. We must do our utmost to create a state of confusion and distrust among our enemies. Such a state of disunity would enable us to sue for a quick, separate peace with either side. Skipping down. Roosevelt's, that's Franklin Delano Roosevelt's, electoral defeat this year, 1944 parenthetically, could have immeasurable political consequences. Right now, the chances of a separate peace with the West are a little better, especially if we succeed through our propaganda campaign and our confidential channels to convince the enemy that Roosevelt's policy of unconditional surrender, unquote, drives the German people towards communism. Skipping down. There is great fear in the USA of Bolshevism. The opposition against Roosevelt's alliance with Stalin grows constantly. Our chances for success are good if we succeed to stir up influential circles against Roosevelt's policy. This can be done through clever pieces of information or by references to unsuspicious, neutral ecclesiastical contact men. Skipping down. We have at our command in the U.S. efficient contacts which have been carefully kept up even during the war. Skipping down. If the Republicans succeed in defeating Roosevelt in the coming presidential election, it would greatly influence the American conduct of war towards us. Skipping down again. The greatest caution has to be observed in all talks and negotiations by those who, as, quote, anti-Nazis, unquote, parenthetically, which officially Friedrich von Hayek was, maintain contacts with the enemy. When fulfilling missions, they have to comply strictly with instructions. This signed Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, March 15, 1944. And we have not got time to go into it, but there are two excerpts, one from a biography of Friedrich Hayek by Alan O. Eberstein from 2003. It's called Friedrich Hayek, a biography which talks about how Hayek, quote, made a special effort to get it ready rather earlier than I expected, as I believe there are many signs that the time is becoming rather favorable for the reception of the book of this kind, and I am especially anxious not to miss this opportune moment. And this, again, the book was published in 44, late 44 in the U.S., March of 44 in Britain, the same month that Abwehr memo went out. And there's also from a promoter of the Austrian school of Friedrich von Hayek named Henry Hazlitt, there is discussion of just how much gravitas the book Road to Serfdom, which, again, is explicitly anti-democratic and equates Franklin Delano Roosevelt with Mussolini and Hitler, and it came out right exactly in the time period that Third Reich intelligence was ramping up their propaganda assets. And again, as we look at this, we need to understand that this not only underlies Thrive, it underlies Eddie Snowden, it underlies Julian Assange, the what I call the Palestinian Libertarian Organization. Ralph Nader is now jumping on board with Rand Paul, who subscribes to this. And it also is very much present in the Bitcoin milieu, the cyber libertarian fascists, as I have called them. Do use the SpitfireList.com website. This concludes Side 2. For the record, program number 798, Thrive on This, Counterculture Fascism in Cinema. This has been recorded on June 15th of 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.